Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to be with you today. We have a lot to share. We're going to start with a study out of Pusan National University in South Korea. It's about ginseng. Wait till you hear all the things that ginseng can do to slow down diseases that are common and also to reverse much of the aging process. And there's lots of science behind this. But also today, we're going to take a look at some contradictions. For example, contradictions between those who say they have our best interest. Everything they're doing is for our good, and they're committed to it. Now, these are powerful people. All told, there's probably around 30 million people that are either millionaires or in the professional class, lawyers, doctors, engineers, scientists. These are the people who have the wherewithal, the education. They're generally highly educated and very good at what they do. But are they part of the problem? Now, I remember when we were challenging George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr. and Ronald Reagan on their policies, supposedly helping the average person. They weren't. They were helping their friends who were powerful, corporate America and the deep state. What about the liberal class today? Those who really talk a good game. They're for the populace. Well, the New York Times had a documentary, mini documentary, it's only 14 minutes long, two liberal individuals talking about the reality between what a person says they support and what they actually support. Now, it takes on housing, taxes, takes on crime, several issues. But wait till you see what they have to show us. They're actually showing us the proof. It's startling. But it also reminds you of everything else that people say they care to address and don't address at all. So we're going to show that. Also, there's a highly respected liberal journalist, does outstanding work, but she says that you're going to have to take care of yourself because the government is not doing a very good job. And she starts with the idea of whose body is it really if you have no control over the outcome. We're going to show you that. But the two most interesting things for me today that really caught me by surprise when I was watching them over the weekend, one is from a very highly respected scientist, a neuroscientist. He really understands the brain. He's got a top position. In fact, I'm not going to play what he has to say because I already have posted that, but I'm going to play his introduction by the professor who's introducing him. Listen carefully. Again, listen to what she's saying in her introduction because it raises a big red flag for me. And then I watch the whole hour, and sure enough, just like it was very casual. Yeah, we can weaponize your brain. Yeah, we're doing it. We're researching it. He was saying all this stuff. Nothing was hidden. No, also, by the way, he is a bioethicist. So he's one of the people who decide what is ethical to research and implement versus not. That really produces a conundrum. If the people are telling us it's okay to do this, and we ask, why? Why would you create something that could cause a human being to harm another human being outside of their control? Anyhow, that's one clip. You got to see it. Because when I said a lot's coming, this is part of the Great New Reset. This is part of the Fourth Industrial Revolution that I've been telling you would be far worse than COVID. And it's happening right now, as you'll see. But then there's something that's a rarity to get. I mean, a real rare, a piece of footage. It's from a leading person who is showing a whole group of people. I don't know who the people are. They're not identified. They're in a professional setting. It looks like a university or a research department. And he's saying how to make sure that you get your message out on COVID, controlling the narrative, and how you prevent any opposition from having any credibility at all. This is about propagandizing. This is about how they go to work behind the scenes, making sure that their message and not yours is highlighted, how you are put down and they're put up. So we're showing you this. I mean, I don't know what else to do to convince you that you've been played. Their house of cards is falling, but the media is still protecting them. But it's starting to break ranks, and you'll see that also. So we have a lot to share. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. And by the way, after health and nutrition, we'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and I won't be video streaming then live on Zoom, because I'm going to take your calls, and I can't do that right now with our technology. So you can call in about any things we're discussing and share your points of view. Now, ginseng is very important. I remember studying up on ginseng back when I first became a dietitian in the early 70s, before I went on to get my advanced degrees, other degrees in nutrition. And I was convinced that it was one of the important herbs we should be using in our armamentarium, but we weren't. Americans didn't really use ginseng. But then I was asked, would I debate a person on ABC television, where I was on all the time. I was like their official nutritionist. And so Alice Fennell gave me a call and says, come on, debate this. So I did. And what I did is I first went to the peer review scientific literature, but not the American peer review. I went to the Japanese and Chinese peer review from their National Academy of Sciences. So when the person said, there's not a single study about how this helps anybody, I had in my hand a folder that was at least a foot thick, and it had 5,000 different studies showing you the medicinal benefits of ginseng. And when I handed it to the person, and I said, well, sir, you may not have found it in America, but then again, you won't find anything on magnetic healing in America. But here's 500 studies just from Germany and 1,000 studies from Russia. They were way ahead of us. And now, of course, magnetic therapy, pulsed electromagnetic therapy is common in a lot of different therapeutic medical models. So it just shows you what happens when people who believe they're right are not. So anyhow, I just give you that as background because, again, not many Americans use ginseng. G-I-N-S-E-N-G. It's now considered one of the most popular superfoods in the world. But it's been used for thousands of years in traditional medicine. The health benefits of ginseng are largely attributed to compounds that we've now isolated. And these are called gingenosides. And these are present in the roots, in the stems, and in the leaves of the plant. And these are known to prevent, get this, inflammation, diabetes, and cancer. They can also help control blood cholesterol levels and reduce aging. Although there are 13 known species of ginseng, Korean ginseng, which contains the highest number of these ginsenosides, is not commonly found in nature. Moreover, of the two types of gingenosides, the more effective variety accounts for almost 20%. So look for the following. Look for the Korean ginseng or the red root ginseng. Those are some of the most powerful, but all of them are good. Now, a new study shows how simple saline saltwater solution can inhibit the replication of the SARS-CoV-2. The use of a hypertonic solution of sodium chloride at 1.1% reduced the viral replication by 88% in tests involving infected lung cells. That's important. After all, and this was done at the University of São Paulo in Brazil, researchers at the university have shown that a hypertonic solution is really beneficial at reducing the viral replication. And so that article was published in the ACS's Pharmacology and translational science. So they used human epithelial lung tissues infected with the virus. So my suggestion is, if their trials work, wow, how about a novel prophylactic intervention to prevent COVID or even treatments for the disease? So that's good news. And it's just one more thing that's coming forward that is natural and non-toxic that we can use as part of the overall treatment strategy. And by the way, on that regard, over the weekend, someone who's a close friend developed COVID because they were sharing some space with other people, and all these people have been vaccinated, but once again, vaccination does not prevent a person from contracting the virus or spreading it, including people who are asymptomatic. So just be aware of that. Now, the person's on a protocol, and there's two protocols. One is for prevention, and everyone should have a preventative protocol available, starting with, and I'll give you some, and by the way, all this is detailed on an article written about the two protocols, the medical doctor's protocol, and that is a coalition of doctors working together from all over the world, hundreds, from early on, treating COVID with great success. None of those has been featured in any media, because if you suddenly interviewed someone from Italy and Spain and Sweden and the United States, who says, yeah, I've been treating people as I would for with any disease. I haven't been waiting. It made no sense to wait. Why would you wait when people have fevers and why people have inflammation and cytokine storms? We have ways that we can turn those off, reduce them, help a person not get sicker. But we were told officially, no, do nothing. Just quarantine until you're too sick to stay at home, then you go to the hospital. Well, at that point, they had nothing to treat him except remdesivir. And that, unfortunately, was promoted by Anthony Fauci. And look up for yourself. Take not my word for it. And you'll see that that study on it, its efficacy and safety, was stopped because there was a 20 to 25% death from that drug. And that's the only drug they were giving for the past 2 years and still giving, when you go to the hospital or ventilation. In any case, here's one protocol. It's simple. Please write it down. But if you can't at this moment, go to GaryNall.com, go to articles on COVID, and you can write all of it down. Vitamin D3 is your single most important one. If you're deficient, which most people are, then you're really vulnerable. So make sure you're getting your vitamin D3. 5,000 units a day. It's a different dosage when you're sick. And that's why I suggest that right now you find a medical doctor that can help you with the prescription medications that you will need if you become sick. But 5,000 units of vitamin D3 a day would be good. 8 to 10,000 milligrams in divided doses of vitamin C, taken at the same time with quercetin, Q-U-E-R-E-C-T-I-N, quercetin, a bioflavonoid, and it works hand in glove with vitamin C, has strong antiviral properties. And take it this in a shake. It's easier to take. You won't end up with diarrhea as likely as if you took it straight. Then take zinc. Zinc is good at preventatively at 20 milligrams, different dose if you're sick. And also vitamin A, 10,000 beta-carotene, preventatively. This is helping all other things in the body as well, by the way. Then there are some heavy-duty things you should take. Magnesium, about 800 milligrams twice a day. And citrate is your best form. And take also calcium at about half the dosage. And then I would take astragalus, 100 milligrams, olive leaf extract at 1,000 milligrams, You can divide that into two doses, 500 and 500. And black cumin seed oil, C-U-M-I-N, cumin. And I would take 1 teaspoon a day in a shake, because it's really rough to take it separately. So take that every day. Now, there are a lot of other things that work that have antiviral properties or that help get the zinc into the cell to stop the replication. But that's a basic everything you should have in your refrigerator. So if something goes wrong, at least you can protect yourself. Now, there are other things, acetyl L-carnitine, there are other things you could take, but those are the basics. All right, there's a whole list, about 20 things, but you get that. But then if you get sick, you should be able to call your physician. They'll already have you on record. They'll have all your health information. You'll tell them your symptoms. And then based upon your symptoms, generally non-productive dry cough, congestion in the chest with difficulty in breathing, loss of smell and taste, dizziness, fatigue, aches and pains in your joints. Now, this could also be the same symptoms for the flu. And in fact, a study has shown that a lot of people diagnosed with the flu, it was labeled as COVID. And hence, we had no COVID deaths in the last 2 years. Well, that's because they were moved over to COVID instead of the flu. In any case, they will get you what they believe, and they're the experts. And mind you, these are people who have studied. And I remember when I mentioned this to you a year ago, there were about 12 FDA-approved off-label drugs that you could use. But now it's up to 28. So we're not just talking about ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. And by the way, even as we speak, Anthony Fauci, the FDA, the CDC, none of them recommend any of these. Shouldn't that tell you something? That should tell you a lot. So we went about finding everything in the world literature, the peer-reviewed literature, that proved that every one of these, like monoclonal antibodies, which should be your first step, are ways of stopping this, slowing it down, reversing it, minimizing the effects, and keeping you from going to the hospital. Now, we have found all the studies that are in existence, quality studies, peer review studies, on all these drugs, and we have posted them. So if someone says, well, there's no truth to any of this stuff, it's, you know, the Lancet wrote an article showing you shouldn't take hydroxychloroquine, that is correct, and Lancet retracted that article. The New England Journal of Medicine retracted the article. And the British Medical Journal excoriated these editors for doing this. Then we later find out that people writing petitions not to take these dangerous, unproven medicines, 80% had financial interest coming directly from Anthony Fauci. And the leading voices against any form of alternative treatment, orthodox FDA-approved off-label treatment, all received millions upon millions of dollars from Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. So I'm just showing you that there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle. Unless you do your homework, you won't know. So that hopefully will help more people. Now, how does stress cause a fever? Because it can. Think of how many times you've been in an argument with someone at night. The next day you wake up and, oh, you got a sore throat and you're congested. How did that happen? How does it happen that a person can end up with a heart attack after being in an argument, yelling and screaming? But it happens. There's thousands of articles on stress. And that's why it's one of the cornerstones of all the protocols I deal with. Because if you can't deal with stress, you're missing a very important part of your immune response, and not being able to protect your heart if you can't deal with your stress. Anyhow, psychological stress can trigger physiological responses, including an increase in body temperature. A neural circuit that underlies this stress-induced heat response has been identified. This is really important. So let's just say, for argument's sake, that you're about to give a presentation and you're not comfortable making public presentations in front of a group. As you wait, your heart starts to pound, your breathing quickens, your blood pressure rises, and your palms sweat. These physiological responses are evolutionarily conserved mechanisms to prepare your body to fight against imminent dangers or to run away quickly. Another key response is an increase in body temperature. Emotional stress can cause this psychogenic fever in many mammalian species, from rodents to humans. What is the neuromechanism that underlies this phenomena? Writing in Science, they describe a key neurocircuit in psychologically induced hyperthermia, or increase in this. The current work builds on a long legacy of research by the same group who began their quest for a neuron circuit that triggers heat production in 2004, using brown fat tissue as an early entry point. Brown fat, by the way, is a type of fat, it's what's called the good fat that can generate heat when needed, and blocking the activity of three androgenic receptor proteins, which are abundant in brown fat and enable the tissue to respond to signals from neurons, attenuates stress-induced hyper, or meaning elevated thermia versus hypothermia, which is where you get really cold and you can die. And that's important. But also there's another trigger mechanism here. And I just saw it in someone who gave me a call. A friend says, "Gary, my blood pressure is off the chart." I said, "Why?" "I don't know. I'm doing everything I should be doing and I'm not terribly stressed, but it just went up, it just skyrocketed. So much so that they sent me over to a heart center, heart specialist center, where they gave me this machine test and showed that I had a, you know, really rapidly beating heart. Okay. How did you feel when you were in there, when you went to get your blood tested and your blood pressure tested for your insurance?" That's what he said he got. He said, "Well, I don't like being in hospitals. I don't like being around a lot of doctors, nurses, and patients. I just feel very uncomfortable. I don't know why, but I do." So I asked him, "Read up on white coat syndrome, where your body chemistry literally begins to change, becomes hyper vigilant, because a normal person outside can go in and suddenly their blood pressure is way off, very high, because they're afraid of the setting. It's on a subconscious level, but it manifests in a body. So before you go into any doctor for any reason, if you can, just try to meditate, calm yourself, realize the doctor's there to help you, not hurt you, and visiting that doctor at that time to get these tests could be very important for you. But I'll bet a lot of people who end up with high blood pressure don't realize that in a medical setting, it was because of the fear of being in a doctor's office. Now, some good news from Marymount University. A study finds that Pilates, the exercise, significantly improves blood pressure in young obese women. Now, unfortunately, we have way too much obesity in America. And by the way, I've said it from day one, we have not spent a nickel nor any effort in a national campaign led by the Surgeon General and the U.S. Public Health Service to help people lose weight in a healthy way, to reverse their diabetes, which is not difficult to do, and to help them deal with other comorbidities. Because the more those comorbidities you have, the more susceptible you are to the flu, to a cold, to adverse events, and significantly more likely to get sicker and die from COVID. So wouldn't it just be reasonable, rational, common sense? Let's prevent as much of this as we can with a national major Marshall medical plan. We haven't done anything. That's why I keep encouraging you to get as healthy as you can. And being overweight is your number one comorbidity. It's a risk factor. And we are a nation that is unfortunately not just overweight, that's like 80% of the population, but obese, and that's upwards of, it can go as high as from 35 to 65% of adults. So when you do Pilates, which is exercising, and there are Pilates centers all across America, you can significantly reduce your blood pressure, and that can help save your life. This was published in the American Journal of Hypertension. It was published by Oxford University, and they find that Pilates is effective in improving cardiovascular health for young obese women, a population that is at risk of hypertension and early vascular complications. Now, how bad is it? There were 9 million participants in this 2018 study. That's a big study. And so they trained using Pilates, and this was the outcome. Very positive, very good. All right? Health is crucial, and you got to work on it. And by the way, we've been studying obesity in women and men for a long time. And the more obese you are, the more your blood pressure is going to go up. The more body mass index you have, like over 30, the more susceptible you are to heart attack and cancer and stroke. And also you have a higher C-reactive protein, which is a silent inflammatory marker against the heart, and homocysteine and fibrinogen. If those are elevated, you won't know unless you take a test, inexpensive, easy test. But there's a lot you can do to lower homocysteine. Vitamin B6, folic acid, B12, vitamin C, and trimethylglycine. You can drop it down naturally. So that's the key. All right? Now, there is now, according to the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, there's a link that was found between inflammation and pancreatic cancer development. So that's new, brand new, a new discovery from the researchers there. Very respected cancer institution has clarified the long-established connection between inflammation and pancreatic cancer development. It starts slow, and it doesn't happen overnight. It's the repeating inflammatory episodes that initially cause the tissue damage. So that causes the tumor formation. So it's called KRAS, which is found in roughly 95% of all cancer pancreatic patients. It supports this adaptive response, leading to selective pressure to maintain a cancer-causing mutation. So what's the answer? It's not that difficult. The answer is simply anything that you're drinking, breathing, or eating that is pro-inflammatory, stop it. Coffee, stop it. Alcohol, definitely stop it. Smoking, absolutely. Drugs, yes, those are pro-inflammatory. But then the processed American diet is just terrible. It causes major inflammation. So it not only can contribute to pancreatic cancer, and one of the reasons that Dr. Ribisi had such success, and he wrote the book on preventative chemotherapy. He was from the great institution in France, the Institut de Pasteur. He was, in my opinion, one of the smartest scientists in history. And I had the great pleasure of being able to work with him. So I gave him a diet. He wasn't common. A good diet was not common to him. But after a period of years, he began to use that diet. And when he did, the effects were markedly improved, especially with pancreatic cancer. And just to mention vegetables, with one last mention here, there is a university in Saudi Arabia, their main university, and they're saying that watercress and the other cruciferous vegetables have chemicals, and you've heard me mention this many times, they're called isothiocyanates, iso, I-S-O, thio, T-H-I-O, cyanates, C-Y-A-N-A-T-E. They've been shown as a potential benefit against diabetic neuropathy, and that's a big deal. In fact, an article on this was published in the American Association of Anatomy at their annual meeting in experimental biology. And diabetic neuropathy is a very serious microvascular complication of diabetes mellitus and the major cause of end-stage renal disease. So if you can get people who may need this onto this program, that would be great. And if people don't have it, good. Then why don't you have more cruciferous vegetables into your diet? Broccoli, cauliflower, watercress, radishes, mustard, asparagus. These are all good, all excellent, all right? Because you want to reduce oxidative stress, they do that. You want to turn off inflammation, they do that. Especially protein glycation. So just something to help. That's the latest on health and healing. We've gone a little longer today, and because I just believe there's never enough information. And there's always new coming every day. So that's that. We're going to take a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to go directly into hearing the introduction of this highly respected, very renowned, and I believe extremely intelligent person who is sincere. I do not believe that this person is coming at his research and development from a negative point of view or lacking in ethics, but I question the whole field. And you'll know why when you hear his introduction. Again, a professor is introducing him at a very prestigious group of all these scientists, and he's given the latest on brain chemistry. Listen to what she's saying is being done. That's the key. And you can download his full presentation. None of this is hidden, by the way. And therefore, you can see for yourself. Dual use. Dual use. What about dual use, for example, of vaccines, gain of function? Dual use means it can be used as a biological weapon. Whether it has been or would be is a separate matter. But dual use, I'm opposed to. So listen to where we're going with this. All right? Back in a moment, and we'll go directly into that short clip.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's my second or third time being out at Livermore. I've been working for a while with Zach, and that's been a real pleasure. And, of course, my ongoing work with Paris and company. As Paris mentioned, one of the things that I do is I do brain science. And I've worked in the area of translational brain science, which is bringing brain science from the research bench to the bedside for about the past 32 years. So I've been doing this for a while. Brain science, as you may know, has also had a fairly rapid development and trajectory of its capabilities, moving from fairly simple approaches to studying the brain to far more complicated approaches that I'll talk to you about today. But like with so many other areas of science and technology, the capability that is conferred by the science, that is the knowledge, and its techniques and its technology, therefore its tools, giving us implements to affect in some way a biological system, renders it relatively powerful to do a whole host of things. Now, as Paris mentioned, of course, I also work as the chief of an ethics center at Georgetown. I'm working within the Pellegrino Center for Clinical Bioethics. And what I do is an area called neuroethics, a relatively new field, but not per se. The idea is that the title of neuroethics has only been around since about 2002 in formal use. But the idea of understanding the ethics, legal, and social issues, and regulatory issues that arise from any science and technology are quite old. What makes neuroethics a bit more interesting and perhaps unique is that the thing that we use as the focus of our study, the brain and those techniques and technologies that go into studying the brain and in some ways affecting the brain, remain relatively unknown to us. I don't care how you twist this. There's really none of us in this room, and I've been a brain scientist for over three decades, who could tell you how the great stuff of cognition, emotion, and even behavior arise in and from that gray stuff of those squirting, squigging cells that exist in your head. We don't know that. If I were going to be Aristotelian for a moment and sort of wax philosophically, what I could tell, oh, you enjoyed it. That's good. So is I always look for the philosopher in the crowd who gets the Aristotelian gig. The issue is very simple. We don't understand what's called the efficient cause of what the brain does. We know how it works as a basic biological system. We might even speculate, and very realistically, why it's important to a biological system. But do we know how the brain makes, quote, mind? No, we don't. Yet, that doesn't stop us, because there's something called the mechanistic paradox, which is although we need to understand the mechanism of how and why something works, we also fall victim to the fact that very often we use what's called satisficing information. In other words, good enough for government work and we'll just proceed on smartly. Moreover, what that also does is raises the intersection of a host of unknowns. If we don't know how the thing that we're affecting works, well, the beauty of it is the tools that we develop help us to understand that. But then we have to revise what we think are the key issues that come from our tool use on that thing. This is not what's called reductio ad absurdum. This is not reductive thinking. It's real. That said, let me take you on a little trip in time into Bain's sciences, what they really do. Let me move this down here because I'm so short you can't see me over the bottle of water. So this slide, I think, very nicely demonstrates for you a relative 100-year history of the brain sciences, going back to an anatomical diagram that was pioneered right after the advent of anesthesia in the middle of the 1800s to be able to allow direct access to the living brain neurosurgically. Now, what that allowed us to do is to manipulate the structure of the brain, and as a consequence of that, see what artifacts occurred with regard to individuals' thought, emotionality, and behaviors. Of course, we all know the prototypic example being Phineas Gage, the railroad worker who got a tamping iron through his frontal lobes, and as a consequence of that, survived, but as the adage says, Phineas was Phineas no more. So the issue here is that there's something ticking away within your cranium that makes you, you. That renders the brain sciences exceedingly important, not any more perhaps in certain ways than other areas of the biomedical sciences, but in ways that are both practical and philosophical. In other words, if I'm able to in some way assess and affect this thing that is in at least some way demonstrably and perhaps to a large extent responsible for making you, you, your persona, your thoughts, your hopes, your dreams, well, look at the power that that can yield. We like to talk about influencing hearts and minds, but this is a question of influencing brains to influence hearts to then influence minds. Continue to look at the slide, because what you see is the interesting dance that essentially technology has allowed the brain sciences to advance with. We've gone from these rather rudimentary examples of utilizing these techniques of surgery during the beginning of the last century, the 1900s, to being able to utilize ever more sophisticated anatomical and molecular probes to understand the brain at a variety of ever more nuanced and granular levels.
It's only a minute long. This is the key.
Today from Georgetown University. He is a professor. I have to read this because it's a lot. He's a professor in the development of neurobiology and biochemistry. He's a chief of neuroethics studies program and the co-director of the O'Neill Pellegrino program in brain science and the global health law and policy at Georgetown University. He served on the joint staff of the Pentagon, and in this area he heads up the EU Human Brain Project. He's going to talk a little bit about that today. He's tasked with his work is dedicated to the studying and defining of current and political dual-use capabilities in neuroscience and neurotechnology. It's an extremely in-depth discussion. I encourage you guys to ask questions at the end.
Political. Researching the brain so you can control it politically. Using it for defense purposes, but dual use, meaning you could use it aggressively. And in his talk, he explains how you can control a person's brain, what they think, what they feel. And this is not in the future. This is absolutely right now. They're open about it. Just like Charles Schwab, when was it? 2016. He said before a group, and I played this twice for you, that they would develop a chip. Everything was about the chip. And this chip would read everything in your body. But then it would also be used for your financing, your credit scores. Everything about your life would be on that chip. Then he said we will go to a state of transhumanism, meaning we will put a chip in a person's brain or some other type. Now, when he said controlling your brain, that was in 2016. This man's talking about controlling the brain where you don't actually have to insert anything into it to know what a person is thinking, how to control their thoughts. So just letting you know, this is not conspiracy. In their own words, you can see the video for yourself. And the World Economic Forum is the heartbeat of this whole movement with hundreds of different projects attached to it by different people. So you're dealing with thousands of people, mainly the Davos people, the elitist corporations they control, think tanks, and the people who have political agendas. So they just want everyone to be completely obedient, to protest nothing. And they control the media. They control and have captured legislators, the vast majority. So they are all powerful. And what their pretense is, you will own nothing and you will like it. No, we're not going to like it. And no, we're not going to allow you to own it. But that's exactly where this is all going. Oh, and by the way, remember when I told you there was going to be a big correction because the equity market was overvalued? Well, it's down 4,000 points recently, 1,000 today, and it's still dropping. I wouldn't be surprised if it went from 36,954, 37,000, down to around 20,000. That would only knock out about $15 trillion. So everyone who thought another get-rich place to put it, think again. In any case, I want you to hear one other clip now. This is very short. Why is this clip important? Because this is a leading, highly respected European virologist, and he's teaching in this seminar how to make a country believe in the pandemic and everything about the pandemic, even when it can be demonstrably shown that information they're promoting is wrong. And this is a Professor Mark Van Ranst, R-A-N-S-T. Here, you can watch him, you can listen to him, and then ask yourself, what if these individuals all over the world did not have the control over the scientific and medical literature and information sites so you could hear outside opinions from equally qualified people who are telling you just the opposite? Example, we have X number of millions dead in Sweden, or projected, 67 million, something like that. Excuse me, 67,000 dead. How many actually died? 7,000. That's a huge discrepancy. All right? Why wasn't anyone called out? Why wasn't the person who developed the model, of which was used all over the world, they all use the same model, in the United States, Great Britain, Germany, why wasn't that on the front page of the New York Times, original mathematical model predicting epidemic shown to be completely flawed? But no one did. Now, what do you think if you said something, if one of the Dr. McCullough or any of Dr. Mahone, what if they said something inaccurate, major inaccuracy? Oh, they'd be skewered for that. So this is why this is important. This is a short video. Please listen.
Play in Brussels the complete naive guy. You have to be omnipresent that first day or the first days so that you attract the media attention. You make an agreement with them that you will tell them all, and if they call, you will pick up the phone. When you do that, then you can profit from these early days to get complete carpet coverage of the field, and they're not going to search for alternative voices there. And they're not going to search for alternative voices there. And if you do that, that makes things a lot easier. And then you have to say, okay, well, we will have H1N1 deaths. Of course, that would be unavoidable. I used there Sir Donaldson's quote, where he said that in the UK, by the peak of the epidemic, 40 people would die per day at the end of the summer. So 62 at that time million people in UK, 40 deaths a day. I worked it out for Belgium. That would be 7 deaths a day at the peak of the epidemic. I used that in the media. I used Sir Donaldson's quote. 7 Belgian flu deaths per day at the peak of the epidemic would be realistic. That is true in every year, even interpandemically. That is very, very conservative. However, talking about fatalities is important because when you say that, people say, wow, what do you mean? People die because of influenza? And that was a necessary step to take. And then, of course, a couple of days later, you had the first H1N1 death in the country, and the scene was set and it was already talked about. And then you had to pick who is going to be vaccinated first. Huh? And then, well, women and children first, whatever. Well, women and children first, whatever, whatever. I mean, risk groups, they were important. And then I misused the fact that... And then I misused the fact that the top football soccer clubs in Belgium inappropriately and against all agreements vaccinated their they made their soccer players priority people. So I said I can use that, because if the population really believes that this vaccine is so desirable that even the soccer players would be dishonest to get their vaccine, I said, okay, I can play with that. So I made a big fuss about this. I can play with that. So I made a big fuss about this. This is Van Ranst is raving mad. but it worked.
That's propaganda being created. I don't know who the people are. The auditorium is filled. It looks like a professional setting. And these go on every single day around the world with front groups, generally having well-credentialed professionals who will give it some legitimacy, and a compliant media, especially those that they can target in the media. Not everyone at any given media is going to be complicit and go along with things, but they'll know who they can handle, who they can give a story to in the personal, presented as if it's their own investigation, and it is not. So just to let you know, when you hear someone say this is wrong and that's wrong and this is fake news and that's garbage and don't believe in that, always you're going to find that that is a controlled effort. And just look at all the people creating the news behind the scenes. Do you know one of the largest fact checkers, news creators in America is? The CIA. Read the article. I believe it was in Covert Action Quarterly. I'll check on that. Of how many people are employed by the CIA just to write propaganda lies. All right? Just giving you a heads up. Do your homework. Do your in-depth homework. I want to share a commentary. By the way, I'm going to take calls, so you can call in at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and give your comments on any things I'm talking about. This is from Caitlin Johnstone. It's called "Consider the Possibility That This Already Is the Dystopia You Fear." It's not very long, but really very wise. Quote, consider the possibility that the Orwellian dystopia you fear is already here and has been in place for many years. You just haven't noticed it because you're still allowed to watch Netflix or buy a gun or say whatever you want to say within a small, impotent online echo chamber. Consider the possibility that the powerful already are getting everything they want from you right now, exactly as things are, and that any suspicious actions you see them taking isn't them constructing a cage for you, but them tightening the bolts on the cage that was quietly built around you some time ago. Consider the possibility that while they've been training you to watch out for communism and microchips and overt totalitarianism, they've been covertly transforming us all into a mindless gears in a machine constructed to serve their interest, which challenges them in no way, shape, or form. Consider the possibility that tyrants have evolved an understanding that you can exert a lot more control over a population with mass-scale psychological manipulation than you can with overt force, and that they have been developing the science of that mass-scale psychological manipulation for over a century. As an aside, that's what I just played you, proof of it. Consider the possibility that we're like a We're like a woman who always feared winding up in a physically abusive relationship like the kind depicted on television, and then wound up in a psychologically abusive relationship where her very mind is bent to the will of her abuser in every way. Consider the possibility that just like in a psychologically abusive relationship, we're manipulated into believing things are fine and that we give our abuser everything they want, while our own free will and that of any problems that arise come from us and not our abuser. Consider the possibility that governments forcibly seizing control of all media and transforming them into official state propaganda outlets would actually be far less efficient at mass brainwashing than our current system, in which people believe they are getting accurate information from a free and honest press. Consider the possibility that if the powerful were able to surgically implant microchips in our brains and control everything we think and do, what they'd make us think and do would not be significantly different from what the overwhelming majority of us already think and do. Consider the possibility that the dystopia we've been worried about has already been ushered in, not from any of the directions we've been conditioned to anticipate, but through the simple fact that the human mind is far more hackable than we've been conditioned to believe. Now go back to that guy. That's what he and his scientists are doing. Consider the possibility that while we've been training to fear communists and authoritarians taking over and forcing us to obey their will, capitalist authoritarians have had us marching into the exact drumbeat they desire for generations. And we only think this is freedom because we've been trained to think that. Consider the possibility that we've been trained to believe freedom looks like being able to buy a gun, which we all know you'll never use, against the powerful, or choose from 197 kinds of potato chip at a grocery store, when really that mindless consumption is just a turning the gears of your own prison. Consider the possibility that real freedom isn't being able to consume whatever advertisers have convinced you to consume. It's being able to think with a mind that has not been molded by the powerful, to educate yourself in an information ecosystem that is not locked down by those who rule over you, and to speak the truth without having your speech stifled by oppressive dominators. Consider the possibility that the only thing keeping us from creating heaven on earth is our inability to clearly see what's going on in our world and thus strategize the truth-based path out of this mess, and that the powerful know this, and that's why they think and work so hard to keep us from seeing it. And finally, consider the possibility that the real obstacle to terrestrial harmony is not so much opposing ideologies as the fact that all attempts to see clearly what's really going on in our world is being actively obstructed by propaganda, by Silicon Valley manipulation, and by government science secrecy. I would add on there the entire military-industrial complex and the security complex, the pharmaceutical complex, and the financial complex, and the educational complex. Add those in as well, because they're the ones who hire the people who create the propaganda that then most people begin to believe. And consider the possibility that the bastards succeed not by overtly quashing dissent, but by covertly quashing all will towards dissent, and that we succeed not by trying to ward off a dystopia that's already here, but by working to awaken the giant within our brothers and sisters from its propaganda-induced coma. And by the way, as an example, yesterday there was an enormous amount of promotion. We promoted it also here for the big rally in Washington. A lot of good speakers, not all what I've selected, but at least 90%. And from my perspective, there were just a couple tens of thousands of people. That's it. In Europe, they have 1,500,000, and we can't even get, 100,000 people. So you see that we are also the problem. I'm interested in your thoughts. 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to Jeremiah. Haven't heard from him in a long time. How are you doing, Jeremiah from Harlem?
I'm doing great today, Gary. Sorry if there's a little noise in the background, kind of near the laundry room. But, there seems to be info coming out of the EU admitting vaccine damage to the immune system with these novel so-called vaccines. Have you followed this at all? Because it seems that, they're slowly admitting in various places in the world outside of the United States that, sorry we told you to take that, but yeah, this is injuring people's immune systems. Just like recently, a couple months ago, they had to add the myocarditis warning in Japan, saying, oh, mRNA is more connected with heart damage than we realized. Sorry we told you to take that, but we're warning you about it now. It seems that it's only in this country that they are just repeating the mindless mantra, safe and effective, and just pretending that these things are completely harmless. So I was just wondering, have you seen any of these official statements out of the EU admitting basically that this stuff is more harmful than we ever realized?
Legitimate question, Jeremiah. I get two sides of the information. First, an independent review of the emerging evidence demonstrating the efficacy of ivermectin in the prophylaxis and treatment of COVID. This is out of Europe also, and it shows the efficacy. In fact, conclusion, quote, meta-analysis, meaning looking at 18 randomized controlled treatment trials of ivermectin, have found large statistically significant reductions in mortality, time to clinical recovery, and time to viral clearance. Furthermore, results from numerous controlled prophylaxis trials report significantly reduced risks of contracting COVID-19 with the regular use of ivermectin. Finally, the many examples of ivermectin distribution campaigns leading to rapid population-wide decreases in morbidity and mortality indicate that this oral agent is effective in all phases of COVID that has been identified. End quote. Not a single American media picked up on that. Not one. But that's only one type of information that we'll get, not generally in the United States, but elsewhere. Now, but let's look at what you were talking about, and that is what studies are coming out. Well, there's brand new studies coming out showing that, and this is just one, that the antibodies from the original strain COVID infection does not bind to the variants. And this is important, all right? This is from a mainstream peer-reviewed journal. Quote, antibodies from original strain of COVID-19 infection don't bind to variants. Then why demand everyone have this, all right? And this was published, a study, and by the way, the work was supported by, quote, the National Institutes of Health and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That's just another one. But then the latest one just came out over the weekend, and it showed that there's now autoimmune reaction that is triggered in people. Quote, this is two studies, COVID-19 vaccines trigger autoimmune Graves' disease in some female healthcare workers. A recent published medical report showed this and gave the examples. Now, mind you, they're talking about all kinds of autoimmune inflammatory syndrome, and that's suffered by millions of Americans already. So when you take a vaccine, you then stimulate that all over again. In effect, you're exhausting your immune system. You're exhausting your T cells. And how many times can they go to bat for you? 24/7, you just keep the spike protein in the body, probably upwards of 40 trillion. And the body has to work on every one of those every day until your systems collapse. And they showed that one of the victims, quote, a 28-year-old medical resident, with no history of any autoimmune disorder. 3 days after getting the Pfizer vaccine, quote, she developed anxiety, insomnia, palpitations, and distal tumor. Her blood biochemistry was normal except for the thyroid function test results. The thyroid function test revealed a decreased TSH level with elevated T4 and T3 and elevated anti-thyroid antibodies. She underwent thyroid procedures to help her, and she also ended up with goiter and Graves' disease. Mind you, this is coming out of Europe, and there's lots of this going on right now. It's just the United States. No media will cover any of this. They're not saying anything at all. They're totally quiet about adverse events. So you've raised a good point, and I thank you very much for doing that. All right? And so you're spot on. We're going to see, I believe, we will see in the next 3 years an epidemic of autoimmune reactions in the United States because of this. All right? And so that was Jeremiah. And we have one last one from Jill from Manhattan. Jill, your turn.
Yes. Hello, Gary. Thank you for the wonderful program. I just want to mention that I received a report the other day from a dear friend in New Mexico who told that he has been seeing quite a bit of chemtrails, and it coincided with he and his family becoming ill from COVID-like symptoms, they are extremely conscientious about their health, and they've been keeping very well. And I've heard from people in Oklahoma as well, in a similar situation. And my point is, with all that we've known, is that how can we approach such a situation if it was shown that indeed aerosolized forms of
Okay, we have a program on Progressive Radio Network that deals just with chemtrails and bioengineering and weather engineering. Please tune into it and read all the articles, dozens if not hundreds of articles on the topic. We're out of time, and I've got to do a one-hour Zoom debate with a major European radio station right now. So I got to go. All of you have a nice day.